This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR.
Kia ora and welcome to Reserved Recommendations. This is a show about great trash, difficult art, and our complicated relationships with art and culture. My name's Hugh, I'm the host of the show, and I'd like to take this opportunity to put in a very mild content warning for the show as a whole. Sometimes our recommendations on this show are reserved just because the thing that we're discussing is in some way not good, but sometimes there are aspects of the art or artist that may be confronting for some people. Check the episode descriptions for more information, and do be aware of your listening environment. That's right, you're listening to Reserved Recommendations on Manawatu People's Radio. Te reo irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatu. This is a radio show and podcast about great trash, problematic faves, and difficult art. And I think today's topic is none of those things, but I'm kind of interested in talking about like why we might call it a reserved recommendation anyway. Today I'm talking to John and Alana, who have very kindly come back for another music episode. How's it going, guys?
Fabulous. Good to see you.
Wonderful.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's so great to have you both back. And we're talking ska today, which is music that I just kind of unironically love and always have, partly because, and this might be why people have reservations about it, I personally am a sucker for a novelty instrumental cover, and ska is kind of replete with those. But there is this kind of, I don't know, like almost eye roll that people get when you mention ska, and I'm fascinated by that because I don't really understand where it comes from.
It's a question.
Yeah, I mean, like a big part of why I was excited to do this is not entirely dissimilar from when we were on talking about hair metal, although somewhat in some ways dissimilar. This is one of those things where people literally don't know what they're talking about and are wrong. Now, this is a topic, though, in a way, though, where I think if any of us was in England, we wouldn't be having this, or Jamaica, we would not be having this conversation the same way. I am intrigued to learn that New Zealand, however, does not follow the British school of awareness that ska is actually highly political, anti-colonial music from Jamaica of great significance historically and to like political musical history. So I would have thought you guys would have been a little bit more Team England in your understanding of this.
No.
But it's interesting that you're not.
Well, so, I mean, I think my confusion comes from having kind of international conversations on the internet, right? Like New Zealand's understanding of ska is very much England's understanding of ska, although we do have a specific not ska, but rocksteady reggae thing that happened. Mm-hmm. So Bob Marley came here in 1981, I think. So not long before he died. It had this like enormous impact on the Pacific Island and Māori population in particular. And so there's this whole lineage of reggae bands here in New Zealand who you can trace their musical DNA pretty much back to like late period Wailers. That's where they get all of their everything from. But they not uncommonly also picked up the kind of Rastafari message about, you know, government oppression and stuff, and just repurposed that for indigenous rights issues here in Aotearoa. So there's like a really strong tradition of that, but we don't really have the same ska connection as the UK does.
Got it.
The UK ska connection is deeper with what I would call two-tone, correct?
Yeah.
Alana is more of you're more of the two-tone expert,
yes.
I think.
Yes. I am of an age where I went to shows that were part of the third wave of ska, which is what a lot of Americans associate with ska, and has a very different and in many ways negative cultural association that is in many ways unearned and in peripheral ways a little bit.
In some ways it is. Like, nothing's above criticism.
Exactly. But yes, my interest has always, because I'm cursed with being just pathologically retro, that even though I was a teenager in the 90s when stuff was starting to happen in Scout America, really, in a big way. I still always prefer the 80s stuff, so that's what my interest is. I'm fascinated that you, John, auditioned for a ska band. Approximately what year was this?
Oh, this is, I have in my notes, and it's the very first note, is to tell this story, because if Third Wave Ska comes up and I'm involved, I kind of am obligated to tell this story. So, this is in the mid 1990s. If you're listening and you weren't around at that point in time, what you'll see in a lot of the things, the fictional things about people in their 20s in the 1990s, is that they are hanging around in coffee shops quite a bit. And that this is accurate. We did not all wear flannel wrapped around our waist all the time. We didn't all have the drape haircut. We hung around in coffee shops. Like, that was an actual thing that people did in their 20s in the 90s. And Third Wave Ska blew up sort of after grunge kind of, I don't want to say died, but like sort of faded a bit. Third Wave Ska was the alt-rock thing that kind of took its place before nu metal. And ska was kind of everywhere, to the point where you didn't even think of it as ska. You just thought of it as rock and roll for a little bit in there. And during that period of time, I had been a guitar player in high school. I wanted to be in Social Distortion, but I'm not good enough to be in a band like Social Distortion. So the band I was in high school, I got handed a bass guitar, which is
happens to many of us. Player. Yeah,
it's absolutely, honestly, I've met very few bass guitar players who don't have the same story in some way. And so I got to be the bass guitarist in my high school punk rock band. So now I'm a bass guitarist. So I start thinking of myself that way. And the mid 90s happen a few years later, and ska is ruling the world. And I'm like, well, ska really idolizes the bass guitar. Ska makes the bass guitar kind of what the guitar is in a lot of rock bands. So there is a band in South Central Florida where I was in the mid 1990s. And their thing was, they were going to play at the open houses in all these coffee shops. I promised I was going somewhere with that. So they were going to be the coffee shop ska band. And their name was Biscotti. B-I-S-dash.
Yep.
Capital S, capital K, capital A, dash T-I, exclamation mark. They were Biscotti. And I wanted to be in Biscotti really badly because a bunch of cool guys were in it. So I went and I went to the audition at a coffee shop, actually. And it was a coffee shop that had like a garage. They had turned into a performance space. And I had to audition, and I'd been told what to learn to play before I showed up. And what I was supposed to know was Desmond Dekker's The Israelites, the bass line for that. But so there's a song called Devil in a Blue Dress by a band called Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels. And if you're familiar with this song, you might know that at about the halfway point, maybe a little bit past the halfway point, the song stops and they go into two or three measures of Good Golly Miss Molly. And it just does this. It's like they're doing the song, they do another song in the middle, and then they go back to the first song. Biscotti did that with their cover of The Israelites. And the song that was in the middle, that they put in the middle of The Israelites, was a song that at the time was current, and it was called God by a lady named Joan Osborne.
Oh, what? That's just bizarre.
This gets so much better because they changed the words in God by Joan Osborne to Bob by Joan Osborne.
Right.
What if Bob was one of us?
Because Bob Dole was running for president in the summer of 1996 when this happened.
Yes.
So that's what. That's why I told that story, because that's the year that was that I auditioned.
That's the most 90s thing that I have
It is the most 90s thing. That story has a tribal tramp stamp tattoo on it. How 90s that story is. The ending of the story is that I was not good enough to play bass for Biscotti. And I heard they opened up for Less Than Jake later, but that's all I ever. I can't find these guys on the internet, so I don't, like, they must not have lasted very long. never had a presence whatsoever. But I mean, in 1996, you wouldn't have, but...
It's kind of emblematic of the, like, incredibly time-bound nature of some of that, like, 90s ska stuff, you know, alt rock, alt punk ska as well, because, like... How would you expect the Bob Dole reference to persist past that moment in time?
Hardly.
I don't know that they were thinking anything past this is going to get us, you know, a girl's going to give us her phone number because of this. Because this is the most politically aware thing we can think of. Something that Alana brought up already is the retro nature of this specific genre. But something I was thinking about walking around listening to ska records in, as we're recording this, it's early December. We decided to do this in late November. There was a lot of you are also in the New York City region.
Yes.
There was a really warm day, like 2 or 3 days before Thanksgiving. Do you remember it hit?
Yes. 60s. Oh my God.
The '60s in the States. I don't know what that is.
It's like spring weather.
High 20s in 20s everywhere else, I guess. I don't know. I'm guessing.
That sounds sure. Right. And I'm walking around and I'm listening to third wave ska, and it brought me back in a way, on like a warm day, walking through Central Park, listening to the Dance Hall Crashers is who I was listening to.
Ah.
And it just brought me back to the 90s in a way that listening to the Foo Fighters doesn't do and listening to Alice in Chains doesn't do. For some reason, it's probably because I never hear this stuff anymore, because that the more guitar-oriented grunge rock has entered sort of, you know, the dad rock canon. So you still hear it and it still gets referenced and whatnot. But something about ska specifically happening when it did at around the same time, maybe a little bit later, but there was definitely some overlap. The swing revival happened. Are you prepared to talk about this?
Yes.
So then I'm going to give the sugar, then you give the medicine. Once again, this is December. We're starting to see it. What's happening is the best films of 2025. Lists are starting to show up in the algorithm. Mm. Best records, the best songs, the best TV shows, the best books. You know what I'm going with this. There's like this year in review thing that happens in the month of December. That kind of happened in the 90s for the 20th century. And if you were a young person, then... all this retro stuff was kind of happening at the same time. There's a George Carlin quote from the 1970s. In the 70s, he said, I'm going to butcher this, but it was something to the effect of any future nostalgia for the 70s is going to have to include the 50s in it because of Grease and American Graffiti and Happy Days and whatnot. And it did. Like that 70s shows hired people from Happy Days to be on it. Like, so mm-hmm. there was always, you know, 20 years ago, we were cool. And now we're the ones making stuff. That brand of nostalgia is always there. But in the 90s, people were listening to the Andrews Sisters, unironically. Frank Sinatra became really popular with me and my friends.
Yes.
In a way
there's a lounge singer character in Deep Space Nine.
Right. That's exactly
Star Trek.
Right. Like, yeah. Right.
For reasons.
And there was this sort of, but it wasn't, I mean, I don't think steampunk really started that, but like, it wasn't like
it existed, but it wasn't, it was very niche and most people would not have known what that was at all.
Right.
Sorry.
But groups of men were referring to themselves as like, let's go be the Rat Pack tonight in like 1997.
Mm-hmm.
So like we were sort of grabbing what we wanted from the 20th century. And I believe that third wave ska benefited from that, maybe was like a first, for lack of a better term, the first wave of that thing, that sort of century in review that happened in the 90s. I'd also be interested, and I want to hear what Alana has to say about that, but I'm because as a fan of two-tone, when people make fun of ska writ large, what they're making fun of is third wave ska.
Exactly. And one of my most viral things I've written on the internet was in response to somebody doing the, when I hear ska is this, what is it? Like ska is the sound of a 13-year-old being told they can have more mozzarella sticks.
Yeah.
To which I replied something to the extent of that just not at all what was coming out of, like, are you aware that ska comes from Jamaica and it was deliberately constructed as anti-colonial music that was, like, developing Jamaican popular culture in the face of U.S. and British imports dominating the cultural market? I mean, like, I'm basically, like, breaking this down and being like, is that mozzarella sticks? I realized I just rushed through an entire history description on this podcast in front of audiences who might not even be like, what are you even talking about? But, like, basically, I do, yes. So people think ska is stupid because they associate it with the Andrews Sisters revival thing, which has literally nothing to do with ska at all. There also was a lot of silliness associated with bad puns and names like that, that just kind of comes in this overall thing. I mean, the reality is the earlier American sort of ska punk bands, like, you know, were very political too. Yeah. And also not mainstream. They were popular, but they were, like, niche.
They were, we're dancing around saying Operation Ivy.
Operation Ivy is like this popular.
There's a bottleneck. There's a bottleneck through these guys.
They were there for 10 years before anybody outside of their immediate scene had heard of them. Right. So, like, people are like, aren't they from the 90s? It's like, no, they're actually not from the 90s.
A lot of us heard them for the first time in the 90s. Exactly. They've been around for years and
the 80s. Yeah. They're from the 80s. Yeah. So, but the thing I was trying to talk to you about the history is that ska was originally a Jamaican form of music that came from, and my knowledge, the history that I'm about to impart to you about the birth of ska in Jamaica is 100% me cribbing from A History of Rock and Roll in 500 Songs. Because that is such a great primary source for this sort of thing. But basically,
the three of us agreed to do this very podcast before that episode dropped.
That's the most recent one. This is actually going back to an earlier episode. So this is actually referencing an even earlier episode. So, you know, basically people in Jamaica really loved New Orleans style early rock and roll. And then as American pop music moved away from making that kind of music, they were like, well, we're not getting enough new records. So, like, we're just going to do our own thing, and really became dedicated to this own genre, which is, in some ways, it's like, okay, Louis Jordan is a huge influence. Interestingly, Louis Jordan came back in American Vogue during the same decade in Review 90s thing that you're talking about as well. Yeah. But, ska is Jamaican music. It became imported to the UK because of the Windrush generation of refugees, economic refugees from Jamaica to the UK. Like, you colonized our country, you better fucking hire us, motherfucker. So, and then British young people were like, oh my God, this is this fascinating music we can get into that our parents don't like. It became a unifier across race and class, not really across class, across race, and then from class traders who wanted to perceive themselves as being more working class and cool. And so in England, ska is understood as this political cultural force that has nothing to do with mozzarella sticks, children's parties, or the Aquabats.
Right.
And in America, there
are, like, two things there. One is that because I didn't realize that Operation Ivy were an 80s band. And by being an 80s band, they coexist temporarily with the second wave of ska in the UK, which is
The
second wave is very short.
Mm.
The second wave ends very, very fast. A lot of those artists continue doing things, but what they're doing is no longer ska. So, like, Funboy 3, like, is like, then they're like writing stuff that crashes
out of the Specials. Funboy 3 is guys who were sick of being in the Specials.
Because the specials became
a nightmare.
Jerry Dahmer is brilliant and has great politics and is unbearable, is basically my perception of this. There is a very intense, Madness continued to release songs quite late and be very popular, but it migrated farther and farther from a sound that we would describe as ska.
They were bigger in your side of the planet, right, Hugh? Like, into the 80s, weren't Madness a very relevant?
Yeah, Madness, I think, were the ones from that UK second wave who had the biggest crossover into being, like, mainstream pop stars. And so as a consequence of that, they stuck around in New Zealand popular culture in the sense that, It Must Be Love was used to soundtrack a nappy commercial. They had that kind of cultural presence in a way that, like, the Specials, people know the Specials, but they don't have, like, that kind of ubiquity that Madness do.
Okay. Yeah. Cause here there were maybe a two hit wonder, maybe.
Yeah. Literally two. That was it. They had two songs that were big in America, and that, and most Americans think that all ska bands are one-hit wonders, which is just something that makes me want to scream and throw up. So,
have you said everything you need to say about the history of roots?
Oh, so I mean, just to put a point in it, Ben, basically, like this is not a joke music,
right?
It's just to say it isn't fun and jubilant. It is all of those things, but the American, specifically the American concept of this, is just wrong. Factually wrong. And that's how we ended up being here having this episode, just because we like,
it's a little
people just don't
like
fucking know.
If you went to the mall in the 90s and there was a kid in a Marilyn Manson t-shirt with white, like crow makeup on his face, and he like, you know, flipped you off and said, fuck you or something. And then you went on and said, goths are all terrible fucking bully people. You'd be like, I see how you got from A to Z on this, but you're judging somebody who's trying to do something and he's doing it incorrectly in the first place.
Yes.
And so now you're judging I don't know why I even made that story up, but
because I was a goth, but that's a great story. It's exactly right. It's exactly what we're meaning.
And I think part of what we may be seeing with the dismissal of ska is not just people like having pun names and being goofy, but is like the Jamaican ska is straightforwardly and earnestly political. You know, like Israelites, the song that you had to try and learn the bass line for is about like taking to a life of crime because you live in grinding poverty and worrying about being shot because you're breaking into people's farmhouses. Like, you know, it's gangster rap, you know, it's tough stuff. And I can imagine that when people from the suburbs who have jumped on this music because it's currently in vogue attempt to do that politics, their problems are, I want more mozzarella sticks. And I could see people attempting to apply that kind of earnestness to stuff that doesn't necessarily warrant it.
I mean, that's correct. It's like the mozzarella sticks criticism, again, I see how you get to it. I disagree with it. I think there's more valid criticisms of what you're criticizing. And on top of that, when you're criticizing this group of people, you're including these other groups of people who have nothing, like, they're like, why am I in this? Like, I have nothing to do with that, except I made some records and the guys who they are ripping off liked those records.
Yes.
They're not even ripping me off anymore. They're ripping off someone in between us. Because you've got the two-tone revival that does, as all genres do, it comes up and then goes down. That's why it's called a wave. And and then Operation Ivy, 86, 87, something like that. And they're very popular in the live circuit in the Bay Area of San Francisco. Yeah. And they, I don't know that Green Day exists. If Operation Ivy isn't there. No. I don't mean
Green Day. Yes.
I don't mean
I hear you.
Do those guys pick up instruments if Operation Ivy isn't playing in San Francisco?
Right.
I don't. Maybe they do. Maybe they do. I'm not going to.
Yeah.
But like Tim Armstrong is the guitarist of Operation Ivy. He then forms a band, you know, because bands always break up. He forms a band called the Dancehall Crashers. I've already brought them up and I will do it again. And then starts a band called Rancid that we're all familiar with. I don't know if either of you guys saw this. I asked on Blue Sky, with what you know right now, without looking anything up or thinking about this at all, would you consider the band Rancid to be a ska band? I specifically did not say third wave. I did not say half of them, I think, are in Operation Ivy. I didn't say, like, just with what you know about the band Rancid, is your first thought that is a ska band? Nobody said yes. A couple people said ska adjacent, which is chef's fucking kiss, because I like the puns and I like the goofball shit. I don't respect it, but I like it. One or two people said, maybe I can see where you're coming from. A couple people pointed out that they saw exactly where I was going with the Operation Ivy thing. And I think it's interesting because the Venn diagram of pop punk and third wave ska has a lot of purple in it, in the same way that two-tone and root ska and like reggae and rocksteady have a lot of purple in that Venn diagram.
Yeah.
And the pop punk thing also gets maligned kind of for the same goofy nonsense. I know that I played a Dancehall Crashers song for my wife, and I asked her, what is this ska? And it starts, and she says, no, like that. And then the upstroke chunky guitar and the ladies singing happen at the same beat. It's a song called Shelley. And as soon as that happened, she said, oh, okay, I can see this. And then, unprompted, she said the following: when you say ska, I think of No Doubt. Right?
So yeah, that was a huge band in America,
right,
and globally.
Right. Yeah.
Huge.
And because if you say ska to me unprompted, I might think of Real Big Fish with all the horns and all of that. But I probably honestly think of the Specials and with like a checkerboard guitar strap and wearing the fedora. And like, that's probably what would come to my mind. But for a lot of people, if you say ska, they think No Doubt. They might think the Mighty Mighty Bosstones. They might think Real Big Fish, maybe. I don't know. And because of that, whatever your opinion of that is gets put upon these other things. And that's where it can become unfair. Because if someone criticizes Third Wave ska for acting like goofballs, I guarantee you somewhere on some playlist you've got some goofball shit. And it might be hair metal, it might be disco, it might be you know, some suburban dude from Iowa who bought a hat and a Telecaster, so now he's a country singer. Something, you've got something goofy you like. Just personally, I think there's a lot of instruments that are not particularly affordable involved in third wave ska. They are really fucking noisy to rehearse. Mm-hmm. You kind of need a garage. You can't do it in a urban environment. Hugh, you brought up the suburbs already. This is maybe the single, with the possible exception of thrash metal, maybe the most suburban genre of rock and roll there's ever been. It is, and because of that, because of Operation Ivy specifically, there's this big, that's a source of third wave ska. Southern California is by far the biggest. And then my home state of Florida, there's a bunch of them from there too. Southern California and Florida have quite a bit of geographic similarities in like the age of the cities and the way the houses were built with garages. And honestly, upper middle class white kids whose mother can buy them a trumpet. And when there was politics in a third wave ska song, they tended to be on the front end. They tended to be the San Francisco bands. Just a Girl is about patriarchy. But by and large, they're about having fun and how much ska rules. Mm-hmm. And then here you did bring up, there is a astonishing, to the point where this is statistically significant, and I haven't given this too much thought, there are so many ska songs of 80s pop songs that you could just make an hours long playlist of nothing but that. And I guess that's because they were kids. I don't know. I mean, I haven't.
It is. So here, there's two things. I'm going to talk about that connection to ska history, and then I'm going to talk about the suburbs as a construct. So
I'm going to, that's absolutely correct. Oh. We are also at the halfway break, so we need to take a really quick break for station messages, and then we'll be back
as fast as a third wave ska song.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. NPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out npr.nz for more information.
You're listening to Manawatu People's Radio. Te reo irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatu. This is Reserved Recommendations. I am talking to John and Alana, and we are having a wonderful time talking about ska music. Alana, you said you had two things to say, and I suspect they might be related to two things that I had to say, but you go first.
Oh, thank you. Sorry for introducing your coming back on. This is what happens when you have other podcast hosts be guests on your podcast. But what I was going to start with was I have recently come to realize how much original first wave ska was itself also covers. So I had always had a little bit of resentment for how everybody thinks of ska as ska is just fun novelty covers of other songs. And then certainly more than I think a lot of people know, second wave ska is also a lot of covers of Jamaican ska music, yeah. Right? Sometimes good, sometimes bad, some excellent. Like, I love the cover of You're Wondering Now. I love the cover of Madness. I just wonderful covers. Second wave ska does not do that many covers outside of ska, with the exception of that, a wonderful cover of Tears of a Clown that the English Beat do. Like, if you can cover Motown and come out looking good, that's a fucking impressive band, because basically only the Beatles get away with that. But anyway, but I have kind of looked at third wave ska's tendency towards covers as being a sign of creative incapacity for songwriting. But so much of first wave ska is actually also covers of American music or ska bands doing the 80th version of a song that's already big in Jamaica. The episode we were all talking about Lee Scratch Perry that just came out as a bonus on 500 pod, on a history of music, rock music at 500 songs, pointed out how many covers of his own stuff Lee Scratch Perry, the Jamaican first wave, like huge innovator, was doing himself. So it is in line with the history of the genre overall to be heavy on covers. But
I was going to say one of the core. So you know how at the beginning of soul music, Booker T and the MGs are the band on basically every Stax recording. So the equivalent band for Jamaica is the Scatolites in a lot of ways. They were they were everybody's backing band for a while. And where they came from is that, alas, I can't remember the name of the school, but there was a Catholic boys' school in Jamaica that had a brass band that you could get into for course credit. And so the original lineup of the Scatolites is basically 1 or 2 years class of this brass band from this one Catholic boys' school. And
I didn't know.
If you look into the Scatolites, the majority of their catalog is getting either well-known melodies from around the world from pop music, or their other big thing was like film themes from movies that did really
so
big, like The Guns of Navarone. They do the Bond theme, and it's all just getting like famous instrumental melodies and reinterpreting them with the ska rhythm. And it's right back at the very start.
But it also means that the utmost quintessential ska band, the Scatolites, are themselves guys who met in jazz class at school, which is exactly how
marching
every
band,
American
but yes, yeah,
mm-hmm. met. And in my school, it was jazz. The jazz band. So the DC ska band of Third Wave was Eastern Standard Time, and like. The big thing is, if you were guys who were in the school jazz, my high school jazz band, and if you were that good, then you could join Eastern Standard Time, who are like a band that matters enough that they have like, there's like Wikipedia shit, you know, that's clearly not by their family members. But that was like the band for like the DC ska band. So when I had been wondering, because again, ska in the suburbs is, for all those reasons you pointed to, including the expense of brass instruments, it was also the first way that a band nerd could do something cool because you weren't normally going to do those instruments.
Really good point.
In anything that was vaguely cool.
Yeah.
But in England, ska is urban. I mean, it's from specific cities, you know, and one of them is, I've seen the Madness origin story biopic film. I don't think those guys had garages. So I was trying to get to the bottom of how did they have expensive brass instruments?
I don't know a huge amount about the specific origin stories of Madness or the Specials, but my guess is that it's probably related to public education. I think the fact that that school is a public thing run by the government, or and even more so at that point when those guys were going to school, would mean that you could get into trumpet lessons or trombone lessons or lots of working class towns. There's a tradition of the colliery band. So the coal mines were often these kind of capitalists who wanted to look after their work, a paternalistic capitalism, you know, where you build a company town to try and form your workers into a utopian community because you can, because it's the 19th century. Lots of those places had like generational brass bands that were tied to the coal mine. So there were all those kinds of things floating around that would mean that brass instruments were maybe not so hard to get your hands on.
Okay. That stands to reason. That's, I mean, I know, I can't remember who it is who said it, but somebody was asked, why are there so many great musicians from England after World War II? And his answer was the dole.
Absolutely.
Because in some, there are plenty of places, there's probably some similar square mile area in Africa, that many talented people are there, but they don't have access to the stuff.
Well, the other reason, pop music, as much as I fucking hate Swedish pop music is huge because they fund arts education and music education in the school system. So if you have any interest in learning how to make pop music, you can get that with your public education. And you'll have healthcare while you're trying to make it.
I still have your back, Roxette. Don't worry.
Similarly.
I still have Roxette's back, even if you hate them.
Similarly, there is a massive boom period in New Zealand music around the late 90s and early 2000s. And there are two things that happened to drive that. One was that there was a brief period where the government mandated a quota of New Zealand music on commercial radio. So you could get your songs played in a way that you previously couldn't. And the other thing is that there used to be a thing called the artist's wage, which was a benefit that you could collect, like a dole that you could collect by saying that you were an artist. And I believe there were some hoops you had to jump through in terms of like demonstrating that you were making some work of some sort, but they weren't that stringent. And while it wasn't enough to live a good life, it was enough to survive in poverty while you had a band as your main thing.
And, you know, like Canada had the same thing of not the dole, I mean, but from the requirement to have Canadian artists represented on radio, which is like part of how that, you know.
Oh, and the CBC, right? Didn't it?
Yeah, and the CBC
as well.
There was
something where, yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, like America, you know, it's shifted so much that if you're instrument-based music, like as soon as you didn't, so much of the DJ stuff that then became urban music in America, you don't need a garage to make it and you don't need an instrument. And now you don't need it. You don't even need any other people. So it's just, it's a whole thing. I mean, but Scott has this very white reputation in America, even though in California, it's also always been very, very always been very Chicano. Mm-hmm. And somehow that knowledge is not something that like people who don't know that scene know. And it's like, it's really a bummer that people haven't recognized
that. It makes a lot of sense if you consider the place of brass Mexican music.
Mexican music. Yeah, sure. Exactly. And then now, this is one of the things I was bringing to you guys. While I got to see some third wave shows back in the day and, you know, whatever, but like I wasn't like part of it. I kind of stopped paying attention, and somewhere along the way, there's been this whole fourth wave that never stopped, and that is far better than I expected, has great politics, like, and on the one hand, like, you have something called the Scatoons Network that exists to do Cartoon Network covers, but on the other hand, the artist from that is, like, literally making songs that are about anti-capitalism, and they've got this, like, I mean, Jer, who's this ska artist who jokingly has been referred to as the CEO of ska, because people would be like, who made you the CEO of ska? Jer is like a probably going to eventually have Lee Scratch Perry level of output. Like they write, they produce, they play 50 different instruments. They play with every different band. So they're in a band called We Are the Union. They're in their own band called Jer. They like play with everybody, just massive output. And all of this stuff is like anti-capitalist, pro-environment, queer. There's a wonderful song I sent to you guys if you had from We Are the Union that's Boys Will Be Girls. Yeah. That is all. And like you can see the singer from We Are the Union in the early one is like out as non-binary. And now they're a girl, like they're a woman now. You know what I mean? So it's just all part of their gender journey. When I remember like talking about like how I was frustrated that third wave is just seen as so apolitical, somebody had shown up with this. I wish I could remember. It was like, you know, fourth wave is very, very queer. And I was like, that's great news. Love to hear it. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, no, I really dug that song. It's really nice to see. It's nice to see adopting the politics of the first couple waves and the fun of the third wave.
Mm.
I don't want to, you know, get up on my soapbox and talk about it in my day, but I millennials, I love you to death. I really, really do. I'm not joking. You're so much better than us Gen Xers in almost every way.
Oh, thanks.
In one way, you're not. Guitars are really cool, guys.
And, yes. Oh my God.
It's a
fan of guitars.
A lot of the millennial acts that have aimed at millennials are not necessarily guitar based, and that's, you know, whatever you're into is what you're into. It was kind of heartening though to see the fourth, fifth wave ska bands.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these kids must be in their late teens, early 20s, and they're you know, six kids playing instruments. It was really kind of cool to see.
Well, the fourth wave has sort of been an ongoing thing because I think there's stuff that I was putting in from the 2010s and those folks are still out there. When
wait, that makes them millennials. Never mind. You guys are great.
So it was interesting to me because like those, you know, people are still around and there also is a huge ska scene in Mexico. I don't really know the Mexican stuff as much, but it's global. It really did become global. And there's just ska music made all over the world. Yeah.
I mentioned at the start that there is this strand in New Zealand music of people who adopted rocksteady reggae for their own political concerns, and I do think that ska lends itself to that as well because it has the rare dual quality of both being fun party good time music and having a real lineage of being tied to particularly like working class and progressive political concerns. And like, you know, punk has that quality to an extent as well, but I think there is a more limited number of parties that you could put punk on at than that you could put ska on at and people have a good time.
Yeah.
Do you folks know, like, the origin of, like, the real integration of, like, Jamaican music and British music in the punk scene was before you could buy a punk record. I mean, yeah, the MC5 existed, but generally speaking, before you could buy a punk record, you could get a Trojan Records record in Jamaica. A Trojan Records Jamaican ska or reggae album in your hand and put it on at your punk rock party. That was what people were playing in between.
Yeah.
Punk bands playing shows. And while you didn't hear a direct reference in some of those earliest punk songs, like the big breakthrough that Jerry Dahmer's of the Specials made was that reggae is a little bit too slow to integrate, but ska, which was from the 60s. So ska wasn't what young people their age who were of Jamaican heritage were listening to anymore. Young people their age were listening to reggae. Reggae is very slow. They're like, hey, the stuff from 10 years earlier, though, was super up-tempo. He like literally put the record on for his friends and they were like, oh, we can do punk like this. This can be punk. So it was the pace and the up-temponess that made them say, we don't just like this, we can play this.
That will bring me, I am wholly unqualified to pick apart what makes something reggae and not ska, and what makes something ska and not reggae, and what might make something a little bit of both.
I do feel
that I'm qualified, though, to pick apart to an annoying degree the differences between ska and punk, specifically pop punk, but even 70s punk, because you've got The Clash. I don't think anyone would say The Clash is a ska band. I don't think. Maybe someone might. Someone might.
I would say that they're a band who do ska and reggae songs on occasion. Right. But yeah.
Where would you guys
put reggae and dub?
Because that song, the Rancid song Time Bomb, that's a goddamn Operation Ivy song. It's like half the band doing it. If Time Bomb had come out under the Operation Ivy moniker, no one would question, that's a ska song. I don't think Rancid is a ska band. I just think that they're probably close to the border. I think here's the one that really gets me, because you know, a hot dog is not a sandwich, but why not? And then I have no real answer to this, right? The Police are not a ska band.
Because
why not? Like,
because they're reggae. They are reggae. Okay. Like, I mean, they're not. They're a pop band. But the Jamaican music that influences them is so much consistently never actually... Now, caveat. One, they took the Specials with them on tour of America. That is how the Specials got to America. Yeah. Two, I don't have deep knowledge of the Police, but I have never heard a Police song that had the upbeat of a ska song. It's
I believe the really old ones kind of do, but not to this, not enough to, for like, what the hell is it called? So Lonely kind of has it. They also used chorus pedals or Roland jazz chorus, and I don't think they had those in Jamaica.
Those did not exist, and that
definitely affects the sound. But it's one of those, like, if a ska band has these attributes short of the horns, a lot of bands are going to have the attributes. And yet, and again, I'm not arguing that Rancid and the Police and the Clash are ska bands. I'm just pointing out that the definition of this might not be as...
Mm-hmm. No, it's definitely porous. And I mean, what I would say is, if I was going to do a, like, a I know it when I see it definition, I would... Yeah. You got to lean on the rhythm guitar, because it's way more... it's way more every single offbeat than it is in rocksteady reggae. It tends to be way more consistent than it is in rocksteady reggae. And also the bass lines, particularly in early ska, there's the jazz influence. But the other thing that they were getting in Jamaica was that they were starting to get early soul records. And so often what you're hearing in early ska, and that sort of permeates through, is you're hearing like Motown and Stax bass lines being reinterpreted through that. Through that different lens. And I think that as you shift into what you would call reggae as opposed to ska, that the bass lines tend to become almost like little low frequency lead lines of their own. Tend to have way more space in them as well. Opposed to what someone's doing on like the Israelites or Monkey Man, which wouldn't sound out of place in like a Duck Dunn, Booker T and the MGs thing.
So what just really, I was listening to, my piece of advice I have for people is, if there is a ska song that you don't think you like, go and see if there's an original Jamaican version of it. Go back to the original. So today I was listening to Toots and the Maytals' Monkey Man song. Mm-hmm. I love the Specials, but I've never been a big fan of their cover of that. Listening to the Toots and the Maytals version of it, I noticed two things. One was, this is shortening bread.
Yep.
Mama's little baby love, shortening. And I was like, what the fuck? And then I went back and listened to the Specials version.
That's another 500 songs thing as well, is that he goes through and chases shortening bread through its meteoric impact.
Everything.
Every 20th century, yeah.
So that was wild to me, but it also changed my orientation to the Specials version of Monkey Man. And I enjoy the Specials version of Monkey Man more than I did before. It's something to that.
Look, and actually that goes for reggae as well. You know, I am absolutely not a fan of UB40. I find them to be treacly to the point of just impossible to handle. But
they're really popular in Jamaica.
I'm sure
they're
because
bizarrely, I shouldn't say bizarrely, but they're I was surprised by regarded there in Jamaica. Yeah.
There are two things
in America.
There is a UB40 song called "Don't Let It Pass You By," which is kind of a deep cut, but it's real long. And around halfway through, it does turn into some really deep, weird, gnarly dub, which you wouldn't imagine that UB40 were capable of. And that makes sense. Like, clearly they've got something that they can do. But also, if you go look for the original version of Red Red Wine, it is a revelation compared to the UB40
Absolutely.
Version.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I hate the UB40 version, and I'm so glad you added. I listened to First Wave Ska. I had not heard Red Red Wine, the original one, because I had been avoiding it. Mm-hmm. And you, the version you included, I listened to it, and I was like, oh, this is good. And what I realized is how much the original sounds like a soul song, and that is kind of the saving grace. But not just soul. There's even it almost sounds like it's church music the way the backing vocals operate. Like it's very spiritual.
I think there is a similar relationship, and this is getting to the edge of my knowledge, but I think there is a similar relationship between church music in Jamaica and ska and then reggae as there was between like gospel singing and church music in America and soul music. You know, like there is a definite bleed back and forth of musicians and particularly vocalists. And there's also this relationship of kind of mutual suspicion a bit where like the church people in particular look at the soul and the reggae people and see them as like taking their God-given gifts and doing very bad things with them.
I love it. Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. I mean, you know, I just want people to understand that the world is so much more complicated and music history is so much more depth than the way MTV and VH1 have marketed and branded it to you. And if the memification of the conversation, and since then, the memification of the way we talk about popular music is really depriving people of the ability to discover and appreciate and enjoy things that they might like if they like had some context for it and gave it a shot. And that's kind of what I'm here for is I'm a defender of ska for all kinds of reasons, including that general tendency I see.
Absolutely. And we are coming up on time. So I think that is an excellent place to wrap things up because that is very much my take on ska music. If you think you don't like it, try finding an earlier version of it and go from there.
What you don't like, you can find what you do like in the older stuff. And if you don't like my beloved third wave ska, I get it. But give Goofy Bullshit a chance too.
Give Goofy Bullshit a chance.
Absolutely.
Like, and you helped me,
And I think that hearing the earlier version helps enjoy the Goofy Bullshit because you realize what they're doing a riff on. Really quickly, because we've got like 2 minutes, plug things that you have if you have any.
Thank you so much. So when I'm not guesting on other people's podcasts talking about music that people malign, I host Graphic Policy Radio, which is a podcast at the intersection of movements for social change and genre media.
Excellent.
So if you like science fiction, comics, superhero stuff, come on down, give our show a listen. And we have a side podcast where we cover Deep Space Nine specifically.
Amazing.
All at the same place.
I don't have anything to plug. I'm not going to waste anyone's time. But I do kind of want to play guitar in a punk rock band again. So if anyone wants to do that, especially in the New York area, hit me up.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Hugh. Don't bother me with it. Bother Hugh with it.
I will further bothering, and if there's a way to do it internationally, I'll figure it out. Thank you so much, guys. We're about to get chucked out of the meeting, so I'm going to let you go. But this has been an absolute delight.
Absolutely. Likewise.
Later, guys.
You've been listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast from Manawatu People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatu. The show was produced and presented by me, Hugh Dingwall, and I also composed our theme music. It's called Sec Jazz, and you can find it at wolfboy.bandcamp.com. If you enjoyed this show, why not go ahead and share it with a friend? You can find the last 10 episodes of this show at npr.nz/show/reserved on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you want an episode older than that, try searching for Reserved Recommendations on YouTube. You can find me at Objective Reality on Blue Sky, or send emails to objectivereality@gmail.com. You can also follow Reserved Recommendations on Facebook or Instagram. And finally, Manawatu People's Radio is a non-profit community access station. If you like this or any other piece of their fine audio programming, why not fling them a dollar or two? You can go to npr.nz/donate for more information on how to do that.